Okay, welcome everyone. Welcome back from lunch. Hopefully you're not too full of food and ready for your afternoon nap. All right, so this session has a big, lofty, long title there, but the general idea here is to go over a whole bunch of new stuff that has come along that, as MVC developers, you can take advantage of. And this includes stuff that came in with Visual Studio 2013 that you may not have had a chance to explore or use yet, as well as stuff that's come out in mostly Update 2. Update 1 had a few small things in it. Update 3 had a few small things in it, and I'll touch on one or two of those. But the biggest additional things that came out since 2013 came with Update 2 back in the spring. So we'll be touching on all those. I do presume that you are an ASP.NET MVC developer here. We're not going to go real deep into any one of these topics. I'll have an agenda here in a moment. But the idea is kind of a broad survey of all the new stuff you should be aware of and the basics of what it can do for you. All right. So a little background on myself. I'm from a company called Soliance. We're a consulting company. We do end-to-end project development, expert consulting in a variety of technologies. And we have a vast partner network with experts in just about every technology out there. You can check us out on our site there at soliance.net. I'm also a Microsoft Regional Director. That's a program, if you haven't heard of it, that's somewhat similar to the MVP program, just a lot smaller. There's only about 130 of us worldwide in different areas around the globe. And we work closely with Microsoft product teams, senior management, and obviously evangelize their products as well. I'm out of the Mid-Atlantic region, which is Washington, D.C. and the surrounding states. I'm a MVP in the Windows platform, so it's kind of weird that I'm giving a web dev talk here. I work in lots of different areas, but my MVP specialty is Windows platform or smart client type stuff with WPF and Windows Store apps and Windows Phone and so on. I'm also a Pluralsight author. I've got 7 courses in the library. How many people in here are not Pluralsight subscribers? Okay, I ask it that way because I find that in these crowds, you know, the subscriptions are going way up. That's awesome. For those that aren't, make sure you stop by in the expo hall there. Pluralsight has a booth. They're giving out cards for 1 month of free access, and you can check out the thousands of courses in the library there. And make sure to check some of mine out as well. Also on various insider lists, that's probably not too important here. My contact info, definitely you know, feel free to follow up afterwards if you have questions. What we'll do here in terms of questions is if you've got something that's just burning, you got to ask it right there in the context of what I'm saying. Feel free to, you know, try to shout it out, and I'll do my best to repeat it and answer it there. But I'll take questions at the end, and because they've only got one mic here, I'll ask you to come up and we'll just kind of do a Q&A for those who want to stick around at the end. But again, you can contact me offline there via any of those means. So what we're going to cover here, again, is kind of a smattering or grab bag of topics. First off, we're going to cover the concept of one ASP.NET and what the experience is there starting up and creating new projects. By now, this has been out since you know, end of last year with 2013. You've all probably at least done one file new. I'm not going to belabor that too much, but just want to make sure everyone's aware of what's there, and there are new things that have come along in the updates in that experience. Then we're going to talk about Browser Link, which is a cool capability to give you kind of an interactive design time process to be able to tweak things either in your code on the server side or in the browser and see the results not only reflecting on the other side of that communication, but also being able to push it out if you've got multiple browsers, if you're in kind of test and tweak mode and you've got an instance of IE up and Chrome up and Safari up and you want to just tweak and see what it looks like in all those at once. Browser Link gives you that capability. So we'll check that out. And then we'll talk a little bit about Bootstrap, which is now incorporated into the MVC templates. So anytime you're doing a new MVC project, you're going to have it in there. And we'll just talk briefly about what it's about and where it shows up in your MVC projects. We'll talk about attribute routing is a new option that you have. You don't have to use it, but it's an alternative to the traditional way of defining your routes in an MVC application. And it gives you a little more explicit control on a controller method-by-method basis to say, this is the route that gets me to this method. So it gives you a little more in-context declaration of those routes. We'll talk about Owen and Katana. This is probably the most groundbreaking change coming to MVC developers. It's actually not directly affecting your MVC code executing, but it's pretty hard to be an MVC developer these days and not also do a little bit of Web API, SignalR, ASP.NET Identity, which are other topics we'll touch on in the course here or in the session. And Owen and Katana is underneath all of those. And in the future, something similar to it will be underneath MVC as well. And I'll touch on that in that section. ASP.NET Identity is, you can think of it in crude terms, as membership v3. So we got membership back in .NET 2.0, and then we got simple membership in the .NET 4 timeframe. Now we have kind of a v3 of membership, if you will, that affects not only the declaration management of your users, passwords, roles, and that kind of thing, but also the runtime code that supports the authentication and authorization of those users. SignalR is kind of outside the bubble of MVC itself, but it's a technology that is very useful for giving much better interactivity and kind of real-time feedback to your users inside of your MVC pages. So we'll talk about how that works in brief and give you a quick demo of that. There's a whole session on this tomorrow, and I'll give you some pointers to these sessions, both the O and Katana. The kind of follow-on session to that, if you want a deep dive on what that means and what it really means for the future, there's a session tomorrow by Scott Hunter I'll point to, and for the SignalR, there's one by Brady Gaster tomorrow. And I'll put those links up when I get to those sections. And last off, we'll finish with a few editor features. There's, you know, dozens and dozens of these little things that we could spend an entire session on. With all these other topics, we'll spend very little there, but the bottom line is the editor experience in writing both HTML, CSS, and your markup in your CSHTML files has gotten a lot better. And so we'll take a look at a few of those, as well as other file types, including JSON, SAS, even PowerShell scripts get IntelliSense and color coding and stuff in the environment now. So that's the game plan. Let's just dive right in. So the first thing here is the new experience of creating new projects in the Visual Studio environment. And again, this is somewhat old news. This, you know, came with Visual Studio 2013 when it first came out, but I'm sure some of you are still stuck on 2012 or just working in a project that's been around for a while and haven't played with this much. So what it is basically a new experience that says, instead of having to pick up front, you know, with 2012, you had to pick and say, am I doing web forms as my primary thing? Am I doing MVC? And you had these separate project types that kind of put a bunch of boilerplate code into the project. And from there, you were kind of stuck trying to morph that into what you really wanted it to be if you had a bunch of these different things you were going to put into the same site. So they just, you know, restructured things so you have one project type that you start with. And from there, it's like an a la carte menu or being in the land of tapas, kind of like a tapas menu. I'll have one of these, one of these, one of these. And you just kind of mix all those into the project by selecting the different options here in the dialog. They also blend into this experience setting up your authentication and having a separate menu for that in the upper right there where you can pick from the different kinds, and we'll talk through those in the demo. And then in update 2, one of the things that came in the bottom right here is being able to affiliate your site immediately at project creation time with an intent to go put it out in Windows Azure, either in a website or a virtual machine. Now, you don't have to do it here, and if you forget to do it here, you decide, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with it in terms of Azure, and leave that unchecked. It's not like you're blocked from really doing that. It's just a speedy way that if you're going to start, you know, fairly quickly into your development cycle, pushing it out to Azure, testing it in Azure, sharing the site with stakeholders and stuff that want to see the progress, then it's a good way of getting it set up front. So let's take a look at just a quick demo of this whole experience. So here we are in Visual Studio. We go and say we want to create a new project. And so that one ASP.NET, you know, really that term gets used in a couple different ways. One ASP.NET in the sense that all these different things that are part of the ASP.NET stack are coming together, especially in the long term with the ASP.NET vNext stuff. But one ASP.NET in the sense that you have this, you know, one starting point for a project. One thing that's new here, I'll just point out, I'm not going to go into details on it. In update 3, they added this application insights checkbox over here. If you're not familiar with that, that's a feature of Visual Studio Online that gives you kind of metrics and diagnostics and monitoring on your sites and even your mobile applications. You can just check that box and it'll add the right stuff to your site to be starting to pump that stuff out to Visual Studio Online. It just makes it really easy to get that wired in. So I'll go ahead and just call this ticket demo. Oops, let's not put spaces. Okay, and this is where this, you know, kind of one experience starts. Now, I just want to explain a few nuances here. As you go and start creating projects, sometimes it's not really clear because I can always start empty and say I want MVC, or I can say I want MVC and that's automatically checked. And likewise, if you're doing web APIs, particularly web APIs where you want a standalone site that's just exposing APIs, it's tempting to go for this one, but then you end up with pages in your web API, which is a little disconcerting, and you can see MVC is checked here and you can't uncheck it. So what I do is if I'm doing a web API only site, I would do empty and web API, because from there you don't need a lot of extra stuff in the project to start with a web API, and you really probably don't even want those sample pages they put in there. But for MVC, you definitely want to start with this one up here, because if you go empty in MVC, all it's really doing for you is adding the NuGets and the references to start doing MVC. You don't get any layout page, you don't get any security wire up, you don't get any sample pages or navigation or routing, no bundling or minification, all those things that are part of the project when you start with this up here, the MVC option, those all become part of your site and get you bootstrapped really nicely. And bootstrapping, unintentional term there, but also means the inclusion of bootstrap, which we'll cover. If you just do empty in MVC, all you're really getting is the references, and so you're going to have to put all that stuff together yourself. If you're, you know, used to putting together MVC sites from scratch, and you do that all the time, and you have your own custom way of doing bundling, minification, all those things I mentioned, then that might be a good start point. But for most people, this is your better start point up here. In terms of authentication, you've got four options there. None, which might be an option. For example, we often build sites using ThinkTecture's Identity Server, a great security token service, open source, or another provider we use is Auth0 for token services. If you're doing a custom token service like that, you might actually use this as your option and then start manually integrating that third-party authentication in here. Obviously, any real site should have some degree of authentication in it. Individual user accounts, this is going to use your ASP.NET identity stuff, and I'll go into a little bit more detail on that later in the talk. But you can see up here, basically, it boils down to really two things. This is the option that's really traditional forms authentication that, as web developers, we're probably all used to. Cookie-based stuff, managing your own users in a database behind the site. So, you know, similar to old membership provider type stuff. But you can see in the text there, it also incorporates the concept of token or identity providers, specifically the four main public ones there of Google, Microsoft, Facebook, and Twitter. Organizational accounts is more the cloud-based token kind of authentication, integrating with things like Office 365, Azure Active Directory, or even your own ADFS in a enterprise kind of environment. And then Windows Auth is your traditional Windows Auth, just either NTLM or Kerberos, depending on whether you're in a domain or not. So I'm going to leave it on the default here of individual user accounts for when we talk about identity later. And then again down here, optionally, I could go and check this, and you can see I can pick from either a website or a virtual machine, and then it would pop up some dialogues, have me sign in, either create a new website or virtual machine, or point to the one I want to affiliate with. I'm not going to do that for time's sake here. So we'll go ahead and create this demo. And then the other thing that kind of comes in with all the Visual Studio 2013 features is a lot of new scaffolding and improvements to the existing scaffolding. So we start off with the typical, you know, Hello World kind of application here. Let me just fire it up real quick. And it's very similar to what's been there in the past with three starter pages with your home page, your about page, and your contact page. Hopefully it'll render a little quicker than this in later demos. So, you know, we've got our basic navigation stuff. It looks a little different than the 2012 templates, mainly because of Bootstrap, which we'll dive into. But basic template there. And then when you start adding your own pages, you've still got the standard add controller experience here. Oh, I got to stop debugging. But we've got a number of new templates, and specifically when you fire these templates up, I'm just going to hit enter, the button's off screen there, you can start integrating, especially if you're using Entity Framework, with some really rich scaffolding. So for that, I need to pull in a separate project here. So let me just go out here and grab this data access layer project that has a single Entity Framework DB context in it and some model objects around pizza ordering is the scenario this was based around. So I can add a reference to that. And then we could go ahead and use that scaffolding to create our controller. So I'll go ahead and add new controller. We'll pick the one that takes advantage of Entity Framework here. And then we can pick from available model classes. So we'll do customers first, pick from the right DB context. And I'll come back to this async option. That's definitely new and want to touch on it. But we click add here, and it scaffolds out a nice CRUD-oriented controller for us for doing the listing of the data and being able to edit, delete, and so on. So it's not too different from what's been there before, other than just the code patterns that are in the controller are slightly different based on newer capabilities of Entity Framework. So we could go to customers here, and I'll need a connection string. Let me just pop that in there real quick. And let's pull this one out. Okay, I think that'll work for us. Let's try that again. All right, so our site loads up. We can go to our new customers controller, end up on its default get operation, and we should get our listing of customers. So one thing you see immediately if you've done this before with old scaffolding is it looks a little bit prettier. Any of the things you scaffold out with the new MVC stuff is going to use Bootstrap by default to get you just a little better, you know, default styling, and then make it easier to customize that styling as well. And we'll touch on where that shows up in the code. The async option I said I'd touch on there, let's go create another controller. And basically go down the same path as before. I'll pick a different model object this time, say products. And I'll check this box for use async controller. Now, what this does is one of the newer features in ASP.NET is the ability to have task-based async methods as your exposed controller methods. Now, what that means to you under the covers is if you're not really comfortable with the task parallel library and doing async in .NET, it'll be a little mystical. But you can see that when I do this now, all my methods return a task or a task of T instead of just returning directly what they were going to render out. And what that means is when your requests start coming into your site now, normally you've got a pool of threads to handle those requests. And those single threads would be used from the point where the request came in the door. Once you go out and do your, you know, query against SQL Server in this case and block that thread waiting for the results to come back from SQL Server all the way until the response goes back out the door. And that is not the greatest thing for scalability. When you do this task-based stuff, basically it's going to, as long as you call something under the covers that knows how to work with tasks, that's task-based itself, then it's able to basically free up that request processing thread as soon as it blocks on something like I/O, like going out to the database, calling another service, or something like that. And so it basically frees up that thread, it can start answering other requests, and then it'll get a new thread to complete the response when the response is available or when it comes unblocked from that I/O. So one thing you see right away here that's different is these methods going against your Entity Framework DB context also include async, and that's new with the Entity Framework 6. So to really take advantage of this, you know, you're going to have to be able to move to Entity Framework 6, or you're going to have to be doing things under the covers that are task-based async themselves. But you can see we have, you know, find async, save changes async, and that means that once it gets down to that level and hits Entity Framework, it's going to be using a separate I/O thread to do those things and not blocking your request thread anymore, and that amounts to more scalability. I wouldn't say you should go blindly use this on every single controller method. You have to, you know, really understand that unless you're calling something other under the covers that's really going to do things task-based async, it's not going to have a lot of benefit for you, but it can help the scalability of your site some, and it stubs all those out for you and stubs out the right changes to the Entity Framework code here when you're using the scaffolding. It's not that this should be the code that you ship. You know, a lot of people see these demos and go, yeah, that's great, but, you know, I actually got to put some business logic in there. I want some separation. But it gives you a better starting point for what are the patterns I should be using, and then you can factor that out into the layers that you want to have in between your controller methods and your data access yourself. Okay, so that's kind of the one ASP.NET experience. Now, the next thing I want to touch on here is browser link. So this is a cool capability. It's basically using SignalR under the covers, which we'll touch on in a little more detail later in the talk. And basically, it is setting up a two-way connection between Visual Studio, your instance of Visual Studio, on the local machine, and any web browsers you start up on that same local machine. And it sets up a connection there so that you can make changes in Visual Studio to your code and just push them out to all the browsers like I talked about before, or using the Web Essentials toolkit, which everyone who's an ASP.NET developer should be, you know, at least considering using that because it adds a lot of new features that come in later updates in Visual Studio. Web Essentials gives you some additional client-side stuff in the browser to let you access it from there. So rather than talk about it in words, let's just go to demo here. And we'll go back to our app, and let me fire it up again in one browser. And while that's starting, I'll grab another browser. Just copy over the address. Okay, so we're hitting the site here in two different browsers. Let me snap one over here, and then I will snap Visual Studio itself over this way. Get rid of this. Okay, so the first thing you'll see is where this comes in the Visual Studio environment is this icon right here, this little kind of refresh icon in the middle of your toolbar. You hover over it and you see browser link, and it's got various things here where you can turn it on and off and enable it. It's enabled by default in a new MVC template. If you want to do this in like a raw HTML file, you absolutely can. I'll show you, basically you have to add a couple of script references yourself. There's also a dashboard here that will show you all the connections to all the browsers you have fired up on the machine. And then you can invoke things for a particular browser, such as going into inspect mode here. And you saw things kind of grayed out over here. And notice as I hover over things here, let's hide this now. Now as I hover over things, it's actually basically selecting those in the editor so I can drill into my code dynamically and say, you know, what is the code that's rendering this? And if you watch the tab at the top there, you know, we're jumping from index to layout. And then if I go up here, I need a little more space. Let me widen this out and try to get my menu back. Okay, if I go up here, you can kind of see cut off over there on the left. Now we're in the login partial. So it's dynamically opening the right file and going to the right portion of that file for the thing that you're hovering over. Now, if you notice down at the bottom of my browser, this is the Web Essentials part. There's this sort of grayed out toolbar that if I click to come out of that inspect mode and go hover over it, I can invoke these same things directly in the browser. So for that, you need the Web Essentials toolkit. Just download that through your extensions and updates. And then you can go into the same inspect mode, and you can see it sets up that as long as that connection's already there, starts doing the same thing. Or the other cool one is you can go into design mode here, and you can actually go select an element, and you can see it selected over here in the editor. And as I type, okay, it's actually changing my code for me. So I can do my editing directly in the browser. And obviously, you're not going to write your whole page this way, but when you get into that sort of tune and tweak mode of, oh, I want that border a little rounder, or I want a darker, bigger font here, I want to change the wording a little bit, it's nice because you can just do it in the context and see what it's looking like as you type it. But then it is immediately in your code, and you just have to go back here and save and check it in, and it's in your source then. And once you've made that change, now I've still got this other browser running out here, doesn't have the change. To get that in there, I just have to go back here and do that refresh. And then, something didn't. Click the right refresh button. There's too many circly arrows in Visual Studio. Click that one and go here, and we can see it got the text change as well. So when you've got those multiple browsers open, it lets you just synchronize things out to all of them at the point where the source code is changed, whether you change it through the design mode in the browser in one browser instance, or you change it in the code in Visual Studio itself. So a very cool little feature there for just having a more interactive experience in editing your code. Okay, the next thing to touch on here is Bootstrap. How many people are already totally up to speed on Bootstrap? Okay, this will be a little bit of review for you guys, but a lot of hands didn't go up there. So Bootstrap is a responsive design framework. It's all about being able to design your HTML so that it looks right regardless of the form factor, being able to dynamically adapt itself if you're on a big screen or a small, a tablet in portrait or a tablet in landscape or a phone in portrait, phone in landscape, being able to have one source of HTML and CSS to draw all that for you, basically, and have it look appropriate on those different form factors. There's different responsive design frameworks out there. Bootstrap has the major mindshare in the industry right now, so that's the one Microsoft decided to incorporate directly into the MVC templates. And it shows up in a couple places in your code, and we'll show that just by talking about it in the code itself. So we've actually already been seeing Bootstrap in action here in several ways. One is, if I go, you know, full screen on my browser here, we see down at the bottom here, we've got this three column layout. And as we start to resize this thing, start bringing it in, we'll see that they're staying, you know, nicely laid out as columns. They get narrower, proportionally narrower up to a point. And then if we go further down, they snap and go into this vertical layout. And that's all happening, you know, it's not dynamically switching thing with JavaScript or anything. There's just a class on the divs that define this content. And the class tells it that basically through CSS media queries behind the covers, says, you know, how big is the browser now? Do I have room to lay this out? If not, lay it out a different way for me. The other place it comes in, if you focus on the top of the screen there, as you can see, we've got a full menu up here. And once you get down to a certain resolution, that menu collapses and you get the little burger icon up here and you get a flyout menu instead. And those are two examples. Another example would be when I go into my customers grid here. So let's go back in here while that's rendering. So first off, you can see you get this, you know, nice table layout with the horizontal rules and stuff separating things. If I leverage browser link to point you to what's going on here, we can see that, you know, this is just a table that has class table on it. And that class table in Bootstrap says, instead of doing the normal raw table you get with HTML, even though you can see all the elements are just simple TRs, THs, and so on, this says go modify all those and put appropriate spacing, make sure the columns fill the page, you know, put those horizontal rules and stuff in there with one class. If I want to make little tweaks to it, maybe I want to say table-bordered. And that'll give me borders on my cells and maybe also table-striped. I can make that change and refresh my browsers. And now we can see we've got borders and alternate striping there. A little dim up there on the screen, but you get the idea. So, you know, that's what Bootstrap does for you, is gives you all this responsive design aspect where it shows up in your code, just so you know what's going on here. Is by default, when you create your MVC project, it's basically pulling in one NuGet package for Bootstrap itself. So we can go look at our NuGet packages and installed packages, and you can see it's just pulling that one in. So it's not like it's doing, you know, rocket science for you here. It's basically just pulling that one in, and then in your default layout template, if we go to our shared views, you can see two things. One is up here we've got the default CSS bundle that's being rendered into our header. And if we go look at the definition of that bundle up in the app start directory, that now includes Bootstrap CSS for us. And that's all you really have to do to start using Bootstrap is pull in the Bootstrap CSS and it starts default styling just about every normal HTML element and then makes all those classes available for you to customize them. And then the other place it shows up is down at the bottom, we see a render bundle, scripts render bundle for Bootstrap. That's because Bootstrap really has two parts to it. It has all the CSS rules that do all that nice styling and responsive design layout, but there's a second part of it, which is a set of widgets that you can use. So there's things like a pager widget and a modal dialogue widget and a Jumbotron kind of, you know, a hero area for your page rotating thing. So there's a number of nice usable widgets in Bootstrap you can use as well, and just pulling in the Bootstrap JavaScript that comes in from this bundle right here takes care of that for you. So that's basically what they're integrating. And then, of course, the other thing they're doing is every time they generate pages or snippets of HTML for you, so like down here in our customers page, like we saw when we go to the index page, you know, it was adding that table for us in the homepage index. It's adding these column classes. That's how it does its grid layout system. Basically, Bootstrap has a grid layout system where you can define a container, and then you can define divs that are rows so that they'll fill a given row, and then you can define columns within that row, and it sets those up proportionally, as you saw, as the browser resizes, it figures out what size they should be based on the current width of the browser. And they've got different mnemonics here for small, medium, large, and extra small to be able to say, this is the point where I want it to change from, in this case, you know, a three-column layout where you can see each of these is column MD4. Basically, Bootstrap has a 12-column grid set up by default. So this is basically saying I want, you know, four of those units in the first column, four in the second column, and four in the third column. But it's basically saying only do that if the browser is whatever the width, and I think medium is somewhere around 900. Excuse me. 600 or 900 pixels. You can go look at the docs for it. But it's basically saying above that threshold, go ahead and use this layout. Below that threshold, go ahead and go to a vertical scrolling. Basically wrap those elements because we don't have enough width to do that layout anymore. So that's the nature of Bootstrap there. Switch back over here. How are we doing on time? Okay. Next thing is attribute routing. So attribute routing, as I mentioned, is a way to do, instead of the centralized routing we've had for a long time with MVC, where you have to set up your routes ahead of time with templates and make sure that all those templates don't conflict with one another. And then when you're going and working on a given controller, you just have to know and say, well, I know what the scheme is that will get me here based on my centralized routing. Attribute routing lets you put it more in place on the controller methods to say, this is exactly the route I want to use to get me to this method. And so it's just a more in place, declarative way of making the code more maintainable. Now, this is one of those features that it really depends on who you talk to. You talk to some people and they're like, I hate this because I have to go look in all of my controllers to find all the routes that are in the system, as opposed to going to one place centralized in my routing configuration saying these are all the routes in my system. But you talk to other people and they're like, yeah, but anytime I'm looking at a controller method, I know how I get there, as opposed to having to go out to my central config and kind of infer from the templates what is the path that's going to get me to that controller method. So what this looks like in code let's go down to one of my controllers and hope I don't lose my voice here. Just take a quick drink. So what we could do is just drop into a method, say on our contact, we want to get there as from our root site. It's always going to be a relative address off your root site like your routes are. I can just say, whoops, not quotes there. I want routes is the attribute, and then contact maybe. Now I'm going to need to do one other thing manually. By default, they do not enable this attribute routing in the MVC routing yet. So you have to drop into your route config here, say routes.map MVC attribute routes. Just call that method. And what that's really doing is you can see here in the execution, sorry, let me move that up on the screen. In the execution of this, you know, the order that you put things into route tables is definitely important, because really every time a request comes in, it's going into that route table and just scanning it in memory. But, you know, it's scanning through that and saying, do I have a match for this incoming request based on the URL that's being requested? So the ignore route there, that one's just for blocking out the AXCs. You want to put the attribute routes first, so that it basically says, if I have an attribute route on one of my methods, that's the one that's going to be found. But if I don't, then I can still fall back to my centralized routing, either my default route that's there, or if you want to do some other customized routes in addition to that. But that way you can kind of mix and match and say, I don't have to use attribute routing on every single controller method. There might be just a smattering of those, like my contact, that I just want a really, you know, well-known, easily discoverable address that I want to put this address out there on. But the rest of them, they can fall back to this default action-based routing scheme of MVC, for example. So once we put this map attribute routes, what it's really doing at startup time here is it's scanning our project, scanning our compiled assembly in the root namespace, and it's looking for all the controllers that have these attributes on them, and it just adds those into the route table first, and then adds that default route or whatever other declarative ones you have here into the route table after that. So once we have that and we start using that, again by using the route attribute and giving some relative path here, then we can fire this thing up, and I can just go to /contact, for example. Okay, and we should land on our contact page. So it just gives you an alternate way. And also notice that if I go back, let's go back home here, and go up to, let me just expand full screen here, and go to my contact menu, you know, it still takes me to the same place, because really these menus are being rendered out with action links, and the action link system itself is just going into the route tables and saying, tell me how I get to the given controller that the action link identifies. So even your dynamically generated links there will point to your custom attribute route. Okay, you can also take it, you know, further if I want a more explicit path. So let me stop debugging. Say for whatever reason, we want that to be slash foo slash bar, however many levels you want in there. And certainly just like the templates parameters that you can put in your centralized ones, you could put a my param here as a URL parameter. And then that would imply that here we would have a my param matching by name, just like the routing system does with the centralized templates. If I did that and set a breakpoint out here, now I can't use my menu link anymore, but I could type it in. So I can go up here and do slash foo, slash bar, slash whatever. And you can see we come in and that parameter is populated for us. So in terms of the structure of the templates, it's just like the templates you put in your centralized routing. You just get to put them on a method by method basis if you want an explicit route to that method, which gives you a lot more power there. One of the features that came in with update 3 just recently is that this system is also now extensible. So this is this attribute is based on some interfaces down here. If we go to definition, and there's an interface that you can basically implement your own custom routing logic. If you have some, you know, if it's Tuesday and the sun's out and I'm in a good mood, then I'm going to send them to this page, but otherwise I send them here kind of stuff. You can wire that in through these custom route attributes and just implement the right interfaces, and it will work just like these declarative ones will. All right. This also, just for awareness, since most of you will probably be doing some degree of web API stuff, just realize that at the current time, if you're not aware, MVC is really processing requests on one stack, and web API is processing them on a different stack, and we'll get to that shortly with Owen. But if you're going to do web API, which I didn't check the block for, so we don't have the app start, you would have a separate web API config in here, and it has its own call against the routing system to enable its own attribute routes. But the same stuff applies to your web API methods in your controllers the same way it does to your MVC controllers. All right. next thing. So this is the you know, biggest change here. How many people are already up to speed on Owen Katana? A few hands. Okay. So really what this is, you know, under the covers, they basically ripped out the guts of the way ASP.NET does request processing. All the stuff, you know, for those of us old timers who have been with it since .NET 1.0, all the HTTP handlers and modules and the way it tied into IIS and stuff and was kind of tightly coupled with IIS, they started the process that is leading to what's is being called ASP.NET VNext. And that process includes a open web interface for .NET. So this is a open standard that was defined to say, really, if you're writing web code, you shouldn't have it so tightly coupled to exactly what your host is. At the end of the day, you're taking in requests, you're rendering responses. Yes, you need some kind of web server under the covers that's capable of doing that, but the code you write to process those requests really shouldn't presume exactly what your host is going to be. And implicitly through ASP.NET for years, we've been presuming that our host is going to be IIS. So Owen sets up an interface that says, don't presume anything about what the host is. Just say what the minimal interface needs to be to process requests and render responses. And Katana is basically the implementation of that interface for ASP.NET and IIS. So it kind of just puts an abstraction layer on what we've been doing for years to decouple the code that we write from the code that executes at runtime. And that sets you up for a path where someone can then take away Katana and put something else under there to possibly run your ASP.NET sites on a Linux server, let's say. Now, don't ask me about the motivations of why Microsoft would want to make it easier for you to move off their platforms. I don't quite get that either, but you know, there are good reasons for this in terms of the cloud architectures and some of the broader customer scenarios that they really want to enable here. So this is already used when I talked about two separate stacks in the current code that a lot of people aren't aware of. They already moved to this with Web API 2. So Web API 2 is the version of Web API that came out with Visual Studio 2013, and they basically rewrote Web API on top of this new stack. The MVC and WebForm stuff is still totally on the old stack for now. And so that's why when you set up attribute routing, for example, you got to go configure it in two places, one for the new stack for your MVC stuff, and one for the old stack for your MVC stuff, one for the new stack for your Web API stuff, for example. Now, where this is all converging to, and I say it in very vague words there in the last bullet, but it's definitely getting much more concrete. And if you go to Scott Hunter's session tomorrow at 8:30, you'll get a good deep dive into what's called ASP.NET VNext. And you know, the short description of what that is basically saying not only for these three things that have already moved to this new architecture, also for MVC and ASP.NET web pages, they're going to move it all over to this new architecture. And the Katana was kind of an interim bridge approach to put a thin wrapper on top of what we were already doing with system.web. The bigger part of ASP.NET is saying, okay, instead of this big, giant, monolithic system.web that's grown for, you know, almost 14 years now with every new thing that they've thrown into ASP.NET, they're going to throw that away and start over from scratch and build up all those individual capabilities as more modular, granular components that you can opt into and that make no presumption about being on IIS. So that's where the true capability to start putting your websites on other servers, or just more importantly, probably having them self-hosted in something like a worker role or a Windows server, Windows service process on your servers. So go to Scott's session tomorrow at 8:30 if you want a deeper dive in that. But in terms of the current code and what you can do today, if you're doing Web API, if you're doing SignalR, if you're using the ASP.NET identity system, you're already using Owen and Katana. So let's take a look at where that shows up in your code. So because I left the box checked for doing individual user accounts for my security model, which ties into the ASP.NET identity stuff we'll get to here, you see there's this startup.cs file here, and it's a very thin little file. It's a convention over configuration type of thing that if you have a class called startup in the root namespace of your site, it will be discovered by ASP.NET, and it will expect that class to have a configuration method, and it will invoke that configuration method passing this thing called an app builder. And basically what Owen is based around is the idea of building up your processing stack out of chunks of middleware. Where middleware doesn't mean big, heavy server products that you buy from some vendor, as it does in many contexts. It really means just a little chunk of processing code that you can insert into the request processing pipeline to do whatever you need it to do. Security, caching, logging, tracing, whatever you want to do, those are all good examples of things you can insert in there so that either before the request gets fully processed or after the response is going out the door, you can intercept that and do something with it. And so the one piece you can see is wired up by default here is configure auth. And I'll show you that code in a moment. But the basic nature of Owen here is that we have the startup class, we get passed an app builder, and then the programming paradigm is that you add extension methods to this iApp builder to invoke different parts. So before I dive deeper into that, let's talk briefly about ASP.NET identity, since it's one of the examples of doing this. So identity, as I said, think of it as V3 of your management or your membership provider type stuff, being able to define your users, manage their passwords, set up their roles, do all those mappings if you're keeping it in your own database, or delegating responsibility to a token provider such as Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Twitter. It's all built on Owen itself, and it has some well-defined abstractions in there to say, you know, if you don't want to use Entity Framework and SQL Server to store those things, that's fine. You just have an abstraction you have to implement yourself. One of the other big differences here is I'm sure many of you have implemented your own membership providers over the years. And the first thing you do is you inherit from membership provider and you say, you know, stub out all the abstract methods, and like 50 methods get spit into your class. and you're like, really, I just wanted to be able to validate the credentials myself. What do I do with all these other methods? So it separates those two concerns. There's the administration of your user and authorization base, and then there's the validation of credentials at runtime. Splits those two things out as they probably should have been in the first place. And then it gives you well-defined abstractions that don't presume exactly how are you storing things and how are you getting to your storage for managing those and accessing those at runtime for validation. So, but they do give you, you know, for ease and speed here, they do give you a great implementation based on any framework and SQL Server so that it's just as productive as any of the previous ones were. You just have better abstractions and better separation of concerns in place. So switching over to the demo then, if we drill into this configure auth method here, it's really in a partial class. It's hiding up here in the startup folder under startup.auth. And you can see all it does is it hands off that, okay. Any idea what's going on there? Let me just try toggling here. Got that. Okay. There we go. Sorry about that. Okay, so we, not sure how long ago that went out. So what I was showing is, you know, where we are is in the startup.auth in app start directory. It's just a partial class on that same startup class. And then it's passing over this app builder that comes into our startup or our configure method. And then it's doing a whole bunch of goop. So I'm not going to go through line by line, but the key things to point out here is I mentioned these well-defined abstractions. It's got the concept of a user manager, and down here an application user are those well-defined abstractions that you just have implementations of those for your given store, and you can extend those. For example, the user, you can put profile type properties, custom properties on that that you want to store, or their favorite color, or, you know, what layout scheme they have for a table. Those kinds of things can be put onto that class for persistence as extension points for profile type stuff. And so it's basically going through, and you can see there's a phase here where it's doing validation of identity, and the default boilerplate code here is going through predefined any framework based provider that goes down to a well-known schema in SQL Server. It's using the code-first capabilities of SQL of any framework, so you don't even have to create that database ahead of time. You can just run this code, and it'll provision it on the fly. And if you don't even have a connection string there, it'll use LocalDB to set it up for debugging and development purposes. So very straightforward and easy to use out of the box. But you can see, you know, at the end of the day, what it's doing here is it's doing these app dot. It's using that app builder to call extension methods that are defined on iApp Builder to add stuff into the pipeline, basically add things into the processing pipeline, use cookie authentication. If you want to use the external identity providers here, you just uncomment some code here and add some UI to let them choose, and then you can go log in via those other providers. So that's one example of using Owen for ASP.NET Identity. We'll see one more when I get to SignalR here in just a bit. All right. So the next thing then is SignalR itself. SignalR, so this is another one that if you want the deep dive on this, there's a great full session on this by Brady Gaster tomorrow morning right after Scott's session. And since I keep promising those, let me just switch back here real quick. If you do have your phone and want to snap a picture here to remember, the two sessions I keep referring to, 8:30 tomorrow, Scott Hunter, future of Microsoft .NET on the server, really means ASP.NET for the most part, but it's kind of morphing into a little more than that with all these other capabilities. And then the ASP.NET SignalR session tomorrow with Brady at 10:15. So just take note of those if you want deeper dives on these things I'm going into. Okay, so then, yeah. So basically what it is it sets up, and I kind of described this already in showing the browser link, since browser link itself is based on this. So it's basically just setting up when you make an HTTP request into a server. Normally, if you know what happens there, is it opens a new connection, sends the request. As soon as it gets a response, it shuts down that connection. Signal R basically says, well, you don't really have to close down that connection. And there's this new standard called WebSockets that not everything supports yet, but WebSockets formalizes this and says you can keep that connection open, treat it more like a TCP connection that it really is under the covers, and start sending things back up the pipe to the client from the server side at any point asynchronously. Now, the problem is not everything supports WebSockets, so SignalR takes the approach of saying, well, if WebSockets is there, we'll use that. But if not, we can fall back to various HTTP hacks, including server sent events, forever frame, long polling, and periodic polling, to give the same illusion of an open connection to the browser. And it basically gives you this ability to push things to the browser instance, or really, I keep saying browser, but SignalR applies to any clients. There's SDKs for .NET clients, Java clients, just about any kind of client out there. You can use SignalR for real-time or near real-time asynchronous communications back to the client from the server side. So for anyone who's done, for example, WCF callbacks to be able to try to push information back to the client in real time, this becomes a more web-based and internet-friendly version of that, and actually much easier to use than callbacks in WCF. So let's take a look at what this looks like. All right, let me see here. How are we doing on time? Good. Okay, so I'm going to go into my project here and just add some, you know, very crude SignalR capability. I'm going to drop into, well, first off, the starting point would be to pull SignalR in. So I'm going to go to Manage NuGet Packages. Just make sure I'm not debugging there. And go to Online and search on SignalR. Okay, and we'll just pull that in. It's going to pull in a number of dependent NuGet packages there. We'll just pull that in, and we'll be ready to start using this. Then I'm going to need a hub is basically the starting point. You define what's called a hub, and this is a chunk of server-side code that all your clients can connect to and keep connection open, and that hub can then push things back out to them. And it can do it selectively and say just that client based on some criteria, or it can do broadcast to all in different patterns there. So we're going to need a hub, and you can get that just by saying add new SignalR hub, and I'll call this alerts hub. And you can see it puts a little dummy method in there. I'm going to get rid of that and just pull in a almost as easy little snippet I have here. Okay, and I'm just going to be very crude here and use a timer. And every time that timer ticks, it's going to be like the old style time services you would call on your phone for us old folks, where it would say that, you know, the time at the tone the time is and tell you what the time is here. And it's going to push that up to the browser, and the browser can figure out how to display it. So what I've actually got here, as you can see, I'm just using this.clients. And you can also do this.groups, so you can break things up and make it so when clients come in and they have to open a connection first from the client side. So that's really an implicit subscribe here when a client connects. And when they connect, they can also specify a group name and say, I only want to subscribe to this group of notifications. And you can factor those out however you want into different kinds of notifications that you'll send out to your individual clients. There's also a client ID that gets generated for each connected client. And you can try to, you know, track those and maybe associate it with the logon credentials of the user and then decide how to push selectively, push notifications out to a given user of the system. So we can always choose between pushing to clients or pushing to groups. And then even down at the lower levels, once you go to clients and groups, you can see this one's doing .all, but you also have a individual client or a set of clients as an array based on their connection IDs. So there's a lot of granularity here that you have at your disposal to figure out who's going to be notified. But I'm just doing the simple, you know, brute force broadcast to all here. And what you do from there is you use a dynamic method. So you can go, you know, F12, go to definition here and try to find alert. It doesn't exist on the server side. So this is another thing to get used to in ASP.NET. Is you're seeing more and more dynamic stuff creeping in. You see it in your route configuration with things like the default routes. This, you know, new anonymous object here, where it's just newing up an object on the fly just so it has some properties that it can use for configuring your routes. You can do it with web API in terms of returning anonymous objects and accepting objects in and not having a type to map them to. And the Signal R stuff is just another example of that, that you're able to invoke a dynamic method that doesn't exist anywhere in your code, but it will basically dispatch to the callers and expect them to have an alert method that's going to handle this. So you're really, you know, implicitly invoking through a proxy a method on the client side when you call this, and we're just passing a string argument to it. Okay, so then we need some client-side handling for that. And I'm going to drop down into my shared layout view. And I'll go, right between, where am I? Oh, that's login partial. I'll go right between my main content here and my menu, and we'll just pull in a little div here with an ID of alerts. And then I need just a tiny little chunk of script, which I'll pull in down below. And you can see what I pull in is, first off, there's a jQuery-based SignalR library that's just a static library you can pull in. And then there's this one, which, again, you can go look in your scripts, and there is no hubs there. This is actually dynamically generated. When you have SignalR hubs in your site, similar to what I described earlier for the route attributes, at startup, it's going to go dynamically discover those and set them up and start them listening for connections. And it generates on the fly basically a proxy, a JavaScript proxy here, that you can pull down as a script to be able to call the server and hook up to it. So we pull those two scripts in, and the way you start using it is you do this $ connection. That's the jQuery part of it, is to get to the connection, and then you can have any number of separate hubs in your site that you're going back to. So notice the casing convention here. It was capital alerts hub is what I declared here when I added it. On the client side, it's lowercase alert hub. Where did I go? There we go. So again, yeah, it automatically does the, you know, the switch there to say in JavaScript things should be camel cased, but in .NET it's going to be Pascal cased. Once we have a reference to that hub, we can set up a handler basically on the client object that hangs off of it for any of the methods that we expect that server-side code to fire. So this is basically defining the function that will be invoked when that server-side calls the dynamic alert function. And in this case, I'm just doing very crude. I'm going to pop a new div into the containing div to show those incoming timestamp things. And then you basically have to establish the connection. So this is kind of configuring it. Then we say, OK, go ahead and connect and open that pipe to the server side and let it start feeding stuff back to us. I need one more thing here on the server side is I pulled in the NuGet packages, but it doesn't do anything unless we actually turn on SignalR. And this is, again, another Owen-based thing. So we say map SignalR, and now we've turned on SignalR. And it's really this line of code as the startup is executing that causes it to go out and find all the hubs within the site and get them listening. Okay, so with that code in place, I think I've got all my little chunks here. Let's go ahead and run this. And we should see a little time start popping up just under our menu bar every 2 seconds. And there it is, starts popping in. Obviously, there might be a tiny bit of user experience design left to do here for this feature, but you get the idea in terms of the functional code there. So you can see minimal code, few lines of code on the client side. Just put a hub in your server side, pull in the right NuGet package, and enable SignalR, and you're off and running with these, you know, kind of real-time feeds back to the client, which is a really powerful feature for getting better interactivity to your users. All right. Last topic here, and then I'll close out and take Q&A. So editor improvements. First off, TypeScript is fully released now. For those of you doing a lot of JavaScript, especially if you're moving into the realm of single-page applications, libraries like Angular and Knockout and Ember and Backbone, and if any of those words make sense to you, TypeScript, you know, what is it at a high level? It's a superset of JavaScript. It basically gives you a more object-oriented JavaScript. For those of us especially that are coming over with more of a C-sharp, Java, you know, object-oriented languages background and being forced into this world of JavaScript and going, wow, this is like really crazy out here because you can do just about anything. And wishing we had a little more structure and a little more type system to what we were doing, that's basically what TypeScript gives you. At the end of the day, you write TypeScript and you use a compiler that compiles it. So first off, you get compile time checking, which is fairly huge. You know, I can't count the number of times in my recent life that I've wasted hours and hours of my life because I had a comma somewhere I didn't think I had a comma, or vice versa, or I had a case sensitivity, you know, just typo in one of my variable names or things like this. You do it in TypeScript, you get compile time errors, just like you do in the C# environment. You do it in JavaScript, you get a runtime error 12 levels down in some Angular library, and you got to try to trace your way back and figure out what you were doing wrong there. So it can have huge productivity benefits in terms of just those little tiny errors you make in your script code. So let's take a quick look. Well, let me just finish the slide and then we'll go demo mode. HTML editor improvements. There's a whole slew of these. It basically amounts to, you know, super powerful IntelliSense when you're editing HTML and CSS. But lots of little helpers for things like AngularJS, for doing things like dragging and dropping an image into your file and having it write the script or the image tags for you, and lots of things like that. I'll show a few of them. And then lastly, you have separate good editing experiences for other kinds of documents. We've had good CSS editing for a while. They added LESS, which is a, you know, sort of a superset on top of CSS, a while back as support in the editor. Now they have SAS, which is another way of writing your CSS using sort of a higher level language. JSON's becoming more prevalent in everything we do on the web, especially with web APIs and mobile clients. So now we have an easy ability to create and edit JSON documents with some decent IntelliSense, I'll show. PowerShell, if you're doing PowerShell, you get color coding and you get IntelliSense completion there as well. So let's just switch over and take a look at a few of these, and then we'll wrap up with questions. All right. So a couple of examples of this, if I were to, I'll just create a flat HTML file here to play around. But this will also work in your CSHTMLs. If I go and add an image, for example, so let me just go add existing item. And we'll go to my demos folder. I've got some internet meme image there. And I can just go and drag and drop here into my HTML, and it writes the tag for me with the right relative path that'll work out at runtime. You've got full IntelliSense for different, you know, all your built-in HTML elements. And as you get into a given HTML element, then it's also going to give you IntelliSense on all the known attributes for that as well. If you're an Angular guy, for example, you can go in here and you say ng-dash, and you get built-in IntelliSense for all the primary Angular constructs. So it just adds to your productivity there in defining those kinds of things. If you were to do something you shouldn't do, if you talk to your designers, but say that we have a div here and we decide we want to put some inline styles, shame on us, but as soon as we do this, we can go in here and, what am I doing wrong here? I should be getting a color selector. There we go. So as soon as you do hash, you get a color selector, you can drop it down, you can pick things, and you get, you know, in context visualization of what you're doing, and it's right there, and then as soon as you're out of there, it gets out of your way. So just a number of things like this. Now this underlying thing, that's actually a CodeRush thing. I have CodeRush in my environment, so ignore that in terms of built-in studio things. But what I just showed you there will also work in CSS files, so if you're defining these things where they should be in CSS files, it also works over there as well. Okay, so that's just a quick sampling of some of those things. There's a great little 3-minute video out on the web. If you just go search on, I think I've got a link up here. It's a web editor features for HTML or something like that. It's about a 3-minute video from Mads Christensen on the team, and he steps through a bunch of these and gives you an example of them. All right. Let's see, the other things we were going to highlight here, the JSON, for example, if I go file, new file, and search on JSON, under web, JSON, weird, general, this worked fine earlier, All right. Well, it doesn't matter. We can just say file new. File. And we'll just call it a text file. Where are... Just change its file extension here. Let me go to the folder. Change the file. Oh, man, what is going on here? Because I haven't saved. All right, I'm just going to abort on that one. I'm not sure what's going on there with file new. Is it because of where I am in the project? Let me go add new file. JSON. That's what I was doing wrong. Okay, so we'll add this JSON file, and one of the things you may not be aware of is with JSON, there's now schemas. So there's a well-known repository out there with schemas for, you know, common things like products and customers and so on. Now, that may not be exactly the property names and things you want on yours, but it gives you a good starting point. And you can add your own to this, and you can point to your own schema source for where it gets these listings. But if I go and, you know, pick one of these things, let's say we'll do a project, and then I drop in here and control space, you can see I start getting IntelliSense for defining things, and it knows that authors is an array, and I can add, you know, other things. It adds all the quotes and colons and stuff for me. Again, control space, you can see it removes it from the intelligent IntelliSense list, and I can select some other one and just start typing. So a much more productive experience for just creating JSON files in the raw. And the last one I'll just show here real quick since I have time. Let me go open another little throwaway project here. Let's see here, where did I put it in? C, temp, I believe it was this one. So if you check that box, no, it wasn't this one, it was probably six. If you check that box when you're first creating your project and say you do want to do the Azure stuff, sorry, trying to talk and click at the same time. Open, project, solution, web application six. Okay, if you check that box and say you want to do Azure stuff up front, it'll create this publish scripts folder in here with some PowerShell scripts. Now, you can always use the publish dialog, you know, anytime after the fact, you can go in here, do publish, and sign into Azure. So pick a profile, say that you want to do Azure websites, and go through the process of pushing it out to Azure. That's very easy. One feature you may not be aware of that came in fairly recently that's really powerful is once you push it out there, you can then go into your environment, into your Server Explorer. No, we don't want to change that. We could go into our Server Explorer and drill down into Azure to your websites and right-click on one of them that is the one you published and say debug. And it'll actually attach your local debugger to that executing website in the cloud and let you hit breakpoints and stuff, which is really powerful. And you can even do that with your production sites to troubleshoot a problem. It'll push the debug symbols out there so that you can do that. You do have to enable, you do have to push a debug build out, I should say that, for that to be enabled. But if you do check that box up front and say you're going to be publishing to Azure, you do get these PowerShell scripts that if you want to do it in a more automated fashion, it predefines these scripts for you to get started. And kind of the point of this is notice the color coding, and you end up getting IntelliSense and stuff as you're writing your PowerShell scripts in Visual Studio now, which if you're a PowerShell guy is a nice improvement. So with that, I am just about out of time. Let me just go ahead and wrap up here, and then I'll take questions. So a number of resources out there. Similar sessions have been given back at Build. Like I said, definitely if you want a deeper dive into ASP.NET vNext, 8:30 tomorrow with Scott Hunter, and SignalR 10:15 with Brady Gaster. Those are sessions tomorrow, and a number of other links up here. The materials should already be up on the site here for the slides. The demos, you can go into my blog there at briannoyes.net. Look for my Tech Ed North America post, because this I gave the same session there. So same demos are available out there already in a zip file you can pull down. So with that, thank you for your attention. Please fill out your evals. I'll put that barcode up here in case anyone wants to QR code it. Get past all this animation. There we go. Like I said, if you got questions, come on up, and we'll do it interactively here with the mic so it gets on the recording. Thanks, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
So you have an awesome tool. The Visual Studio provides an awesome tool called T4 templates. And the question is, why the Microsoft never provided kind of support for T4 files or kind of IntelliSense, or at least put some colors in it? And if you will ever provide something like that?
That's an excellent question. So I should caveat by saying I am not a Microsoft employee. I can't really answer, you know, the whys or wherefores there. I have often, you know, wished for the same thing myself, that it's kind of you're on your own when you're in the T4 land. You know, the best way to do that is they've got various user voice forums out there for features for Visual Studio. Go out there and see if there's already a user voice item there and vote it up, okay. Or put one out there if there's not.
Okay.
Because they really use those user voice to drive their feature list for updates and new stuff in Visual Studio.
Okay, I actually put that question on Microsoft's forum, saying that they have company that they work with, and that company provides support for that kind of files, and it's people have to pay to use that.
They sometimes do that.
But for some unknown reason, my question disappeared from the forum.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, Microsoft does often choose, you know, intentionally to say, we're going to leave that open as a, you know, an arena for third-party people to thrive in.
Okay.
And I can't say what, you know, drives those decisions and so on, but yeah. I've seen that response before.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Sir.
Hi, Brian.
Hey.
I wanted to ask about Browser Link.
Uh-huh.
We use Less quite a lot. I wondered whether Browser Link up and down would support Less, and, you know, if you make changes in the CSS that's been driven by.
Yes, and I should have showed that in the demo, but you know, the magic sauce there that's driving Browser Link is if you go look at your source in the browser, at the bottom of the page, what ASP.NET is doing is injecting a couple of script references there, and it's code similar to what I showed with the Signal R that establishes a connection back to Visual Studio and lets it push the changes back up. It's really just driving a refresh in the browser, you know, from Visual Studio anytime you've changed anything, but those changes apply to any of your client-side resources, whether they're, you know, well, raw CSS, so off the top of my head, you said Less or Sass?
Yes, yeah, so it might push it up to the CSS file, but would it be clever enough to push it back to the Less file that
if you've got it, you know, if you've got it automated in your environment that you make your change in Less and save and it produces the CSS, then yes. Because as soon as that server-side resource changes in any way, whether it's hand typing or a tool that changes things on save. The same thing happens with TypeScript, for example. You're never really running TypeScript in the browser. You're running the produced JavaScript, and that's what's running in the browser. But the same thing applies. You can go edit your TypeScript, save, and it's the save point that it compiles it and turns it into JavaScript. So the same would be true for tools with Less and Sass.
Would that work coming back from the browser as well, like if you make a change down in the browser?
I don't know that you can edit it in the browser off the top of my head. I'm not saying you can't, I just haven't tried to see if it works.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.